Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. It's a great pleasure. I just move this way. Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm Cengiz Pehlev, and I'm a research scientist at the Flatiron Institute. And today I'll be speaking to you about learning. And learning is a, big function of the brain. It's a hard problem to solve if we understand how that works. That will be a major accomplishment for neuroscience, but also will have huge implications for artificial systems. And we know little about how the brain learns. Take, for example, the task of learning a cat from a dog, for example. Modern machine learning is running to triumphs after triumphs in tasks like this. But the machine learning algorithms, the way they solve this problem is fundamentally different than the way we solve it. They will solve it as follows, right? They'll look at a bunch of pictures of cats and dogs, all labeled, in a setting which is so-called supervised. And from this large number of labeled examples, we'll try to come up, basically infer a clever way to solve this task. But the way we solve it is much different. We don't need like sort of millions of cats and dog images to solve this task. What we are doing instead is we're constantly being bombarded with stimuli, basically images and of all sorts of things. Our brain is doing its plasticity and building its representations over time. So by the time it comes that and we're asked to solve this task of telling a cat from a dog, we can solve this by basically from a few examples. So the bulk of the, or much of the learning is happening here, where no one is providing us any labels and we're being constantly bombarded with all these kind of stimuli, which is called unsupervised learning. So to understand learning in the brain, we have to understand how unsupervised learning works. And at the heart of unsupervised learning is these two notions, plasticity and representation, and I'll be talking about these a lot today. And just to make sure we're on the same page, let me tell you what I mean clearly, what representation is. For the purposes of this talk, I'll be thinking of stimuli, and these could be images of cats, for example, that fall into your retina. I'll abstract these things as vectors in n-dimensional space. So think of an image. I can take the pixel intensity values and concatenate into a large vector. So that will be what goes into my system. And in response to this stimulus, there will be a population of neurons in your brain which are producing spikes. I'll do some time averaging of them and come up with firing rates, and I'll take this population activity of firing rates into a k-dimensional vector and call this the representation. So the mapping between x and y is the thing that I'm trying to learn. But then we can start asking the following questions, right? What is a good representation? What is this y that I'm trying to learn? Suppose I have an answer to that, then I can ask, what kind of algorithms are there that learns such representations and produces them? And suppose I had an answer to that too, you can ask, what kind of biological mechanisms are there mechanistically implementing such algorithms? And I'm sure many of you in the audience have sort of realized I'm talking about Mars 3 levels of analysis here. And as a sort of a theoretical neuroscientist, my goal has been not just to build theories that addresses these questions in these sort of different levels of description, but build theories of biological learning that bridges to so-called computational, algorithmic, and mechanistic levels of description. Of course, we are nowhere near that. That's a sort of a dream. But suppose for a moment, we had a theory of this sort. What would it buy us, right? If you had an idea of what a good representation is, you could go down these arrows and come up with, biologically plausible circuits that would sort of learn such representations, and that would give you, make predictions about particular connectivity and plasticity and dynamics that you will see in your circuits. Or on the contrary, you could take your biological observations and go up these up arrows and come up with computational interpretations of what these biological experimental results that you see. And along the way, of course, you can take the lessons that you took about algorithms and apply it to artificial systems. And, that's a good thing. That will make all of us rich. So that's a good thing. Okay, so I said this is a dream. That's a long way from there. But I have an approach to this problem that I've been pursuing for the last few years. And I want to share it with you today. And this is the slide that shows what this approach is. I'll go over it. It's basically schematized here in three blocks. And above here is where I think these blocks are sort of mapping to those questions that have arisen. So the main approach is in this question is following. I start by thinking about learning problems. And this, I will be talking about things like clustering, feature extraction, source separation, and so on and so forth today. And here I'll be thinking, what could be a goal of computational processing for this particular representation? Then comes the key step. I take these words and mathematically formalize it as an optimization problem, okay? Which means I'm asserting that representations are optima or minima of certain cost functions. And this is sort of the key step, because once you start thinking about cost functions, you're immediately thinking of ways, algorithms with which to optimize them, and that gives you sort of the algorithmic step. And here we have to be careful about how the brain processes data, right? So a stimulus comes and representation is produced, and the next stimulus comes and the next representation is produced. We don't buffer these stimuli for a long time, so processing happens online. Therefore, the algorithms we come up with has to obey that principle. And the next step is taking that algorithm and interpreting it or mapping it to the operations of a neural network. And the way I will do it is basically you'll see that all the details of the network, architecture, dynamics, plasticity, all of them are going to come from this this procedure. Now, normally, I would have another block here for this online algorithm step. That's where all the math is hidden. Okay. So for today's talk, I'll not talk about the math. Basically, therefore, I reduced from a block to just a line here. And that will be the sort of methodological way I approach this problem. And I have been doing this for the last few years over and over again. And that's the result of this work. What you're seeing on the left is a bunch of unsupervised learning problems, and I'll talk about many of them today. Things like dimensionality reduction in the sense of principal component analysis, clustering, redundancy reduction, so on and so forth. And on the right, you're seeing a bunch of circuit motifs that come out of such exercise. They have features like, you know, multiple populations of neurons, recurrent processing. This is an interesting one. I'll talk about this later on. And, you know, certain kinds of nonlinearities and homeostatic plasticity, and so on and so forth. I'll come back to this slide later on and tell you more about it. But what I want to tell you today is basically the story of how I got here. What I'm doing with this, I call this a catalog of circuits, and what I plan to do with it in the future. Okay? So to make this program work, I had to start with solving one major problem, and that problem has to do with synaptic plasticity. Okay? So plasticity is basically the major mechanistic sort of thing that the brain is using to learn. So here's a Wikipedia depiction of the brain's hardware. These are neurons making contact to each other through synapses, okay? So basically the efficacy of these synapses are subject to change based on the stimuli that you're seeing or the activity in the circuit. But if you look at how the activity here changes, it's local by I mean physical locality, by which I mean the following fact. The information available to the synapse is only the activity of the presynaptic neuron and the postsynaptic neuron. And perhaps, you know, some understanding of the homeostatic state of the postsynaptic neuron too. So that's basically the state of two neurons. Out of 100 billion neurons in your brain, this neuron only knows about the state of two neurons. Yet, this very unlimited knowledge, it's supposed to make clever decisions with respect to whether it should get stronger or weaker, right? So that's a challenging problem to solve. And I'm basically telling you I'm going to do this with optimization problems. How can uninformed decisions made by a synapse, right, so it's really uninformed, very little information, by any sense be optimal? So that's the question that I had to solve to be able to make this program work, okay? And I'm not the first person to attempt doing this. So there's a huge literature on unsupervised learning in the brain. I'm not having a slide on this. So this is only a slide about the other people who took the particular approach that I took, basically started with optimization problems, and from there tried to derive neural networks. And here are some famous people that work in the field. And if you look at the optimization problems that they've used, they all can be summarized by minimizing reconstruction error, which is the following idea. We're postulating that you should be able to reconstruct what the image was from recordings of neurons. That's the idea, right? The best representation is the one from which images could be reconstructed. And if you look at all these papers, they'll start from this cost function, come up with a neural network, and if you look at the plasticity rules, it will be non-local, meaning that to be able to update a synapse, you need information from, for example, about the states of other neurons, which are not on that particular synapse. So that's a problem. Of course, these people being smart people, they realized that this was a problem, and they tried to come up with mathematical tricks to solve this problem. So at first, it might look like they solved the problem, but if you look closely, what you'll realize that they cheated a little bit because they had to introduce what I call instantaneous neurons, which are basically broadcasting information across the network at the speed of light. So that's not a solution. Okay, so what is the solution? Well, I'll argue that the solution is to basically start with a different class of cost functions. Okay, so if you want to get local plasticity here, you need to start with a new class of cost functions built from similarities. What do I mean by similarities? Let me explain. So here is again a bunch of images, and here's vectors that represent those images. Again, maybe think of them as firing rates of populations of neurons. You are naturally inclined to think that these vectors are representing those images, right? So that makes sense. What I said in the beginning, and that was the reconstruction people are thinking of. What I'm suggesting is a change of point of view. What I'm saying, what you should be doing, is basically this. The similarity between images should be represented by the similarity of the firing rate vectors. In other words, representation is representation of similarities. Now, this idea is actually a title of a paper, Shimon Edelman, a famous psychologist, and it turns out that this representation should be representation of similarities goes all the way to Aristoteles. Okay, but what I'm going to do today is put math into this and from there try to map this sort of high-level idea to the mechanistic workings of a neural circuit. Okay. And let me try to motivate this a bit more by some experimental data. So what you're seeing here is recordings from IT cortex, so that's inferior temporal cortex. That's pretty high in visual hierarchy, okay? Just around here somewhere. And the neurons here are known to be responsive or selective to objects, things like faces, all right, and shapes. So it's pretty high level of processing has gone by the time you reach here. And the experiment that's been doing, so this is recordings from the IT cortex, this is functional MRI recordings. The experiment that's been done here is the following. Subjects are taken, and they are shown about 100 different objects, okay? So that's a 100 by 100 matrix, each corresponding to a particular object, okay? And what's being shown is the similarity of neural representations with respect to pairs of objects. Right? So blue means similar, red means dissimilar. What the images are, what this matrix is conveying is the following idea. Semantically similar objects, meaning like body parts or faces, lead to more similar representations than semantically dissimilar objects, like for example, body and body part and key, for example. That's what this is showing. So the brain seems to be caring about similarities, but not just that. This matrix turns out to be repeatable across different subjects. And not just that, it is repeatable across species. So this is the same matrix recorded from a monkey IT cortex. Okay, this time the recordings are not fMRI, but are actually electrophysiology. And if you look at the structure of these matrices, it's amazingly preserved, right? So the representations in the monkey IT cortex, at least the similarity of them, seem to match what's in our brains. And it's interesting because if I gave you the total firing rate vector of a monkey IT cortex and a human IT cortex, they'll not look the same. If I told you how to compare them, God knows what. But the similarity matrices themselves seem to be really preserved across even different species, right? So as a theorist, basically I take from this two lessons. One, the one I told you, the brain cares about similarities. But two, because this seems to be a sort of a more fundamental thing, if I want to build theories of neural computation, I should put similarity matrices as these building blocks. And that's what I'm going to do in the next few slides. But if you buy into this point of view, okay, by the way, I should say that these are not, I didn't do these experiments. They're coming from Kriegel-Skorte and Rusbeck-Chiani. But if you buy into this point of view, then computation so can be thought of as a cascade of similarity transformations. So here is a bunch of areas in the brain that lead to processing of sort of object recognition. So the one I showed you, IT, is here, but by the time you come to IT, you have gone through multiple levels of processing, and you can plot the same similarity matrices for all these areas, and you'll find that they are different. Right? So basically, similarity matrices are in cascades of computation evolving to reach there. And if computation is basically transformation as matrices, then we can think of learning as basically learning of similarity transformations. Okay? So that's what I'm going to go with. And what I'm going to show you next is basically how this idea can be used to basically build a neural circuit that might be applicable to sort of the first layers of processing from stimuli to low-level feature learning. Okay? So basically, I'll take the similarity idea, combine it with the cost function framework, and come up with a biological circuit. And that's what I'm going to do next. Okay? And the particular optimization problem that I'm going to introduce is going to be called similarity matching. So, and along the way, so you'll have a smaller version of this diagram here, and purple means where I am on that on the program. So just if you get confused, you can follow where I am from there. Okay. So let's talk about computational goals. So here I'm thinking of basically feature extraction. So if that's not clear, it will be clear in a few slides. So I'm going to be talking about looking at basically natural scenes. Think of T of them, so each vector is an image. And with response to that, I'll be producing T population firing rates. So T vectors go in, T vectors come out. And they might have different dimensionality, right? So there's millions of neurons here. There's I don't know how many pixels here. Okay, and I'll postulate that the following is a good way to learn features. Similarity matching principle, similar inputs should map to similar outputs. Simple idea. So how can we make a cost function out of this? Very simple. I'll take these vectors and from basically take simple dot products as measures of similarity. For T inputs, I'm going to have a T by T matrix as input similarity matrix. And correspondingly, at the output, I'm going to have T by T output similarity matrix. And my principle says this should be similar to that, or this should basically match that. Just to make sure we're on the same page, I'm learning what Y's are given X's, and that can be turned into an optimization problem by subtracting this element Y's, squaring it, and summing over all the matrix elements, right? So, and I'll introduce a non-negativity constraint at the output because firing rates are non-negative, and I'll call this non-negative similarity matching cost function, and the name is sort of obvious. And you can ask me why is Y equal to X not a solution to this? There can be a few reasons. For example, that the dimensionality here might be different than that. X represents stimuli. It might have negative elements in them, but these are all non-negative elements, so you may not be able to match this. Later on, I'm going to add sort of more stuff here, which is going to make the Y equal to X to X solution not hold. Okay, so that's the cost function that I'm going to work with. But I've been promising you that this has something to do with neural processing and how does that work and learning. Well, if I try to start relating this to learning, I'm running into two problems. Immediately, the cost function has inputs and outputs in them, right? I've been telling you that learning is happening in synaptic weights. Where are the synaptic weights? That's one problem, right? And to solve that, so I'll just do a simple trick. I'll expand the square and drop the first term here, which does not depend on y. I also moved in the summation over t inside and regrouped everything, so there's no big trick here. Okay, it's just the same thing over here. But when I do this step, something gets revealed, which shows why similarity is good for neural learning. Because look at what these matrices are. They are correlation matrices. This is a correlation of input to output and output to output. And why is that a good thing? Because in neuroscience, we have this principle called the Hebbian principle, right? For a long time, people have been postulating or thinking that synaptic rates between neurons have to be a function of the correlations between them. So then that's where the correlations are. So perhaps that's where the synaptic rates are hidden. So in my formal derivation, which I'm not going to show here, there will be steps where I will be substituting these matrices with other variables, which will be a W variable and an L variable. Okay, and I'll call them feed forward and lateral synaptic rate, which will be apparent in the next slide. But you can see why this is feed forward, because it's x to y, input to output, and this is lateral because it's y to y. And now, this is a physics audience. I want to use this word. It's a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation I'm doing here. Okay, or computing the square is another way I would say this. Okay, so that solves that problem. And the second problem, I've been talking about online algorithms, right? But this optimization is with respect to everybody at the same time. I'm seeing everyone and producing everybody at the same time, all outputs at the same time. And to solve that problem, I do basically ignore everything I've produced in the past. I say, I produced those guys already. I cannot change them. I cannot do anything. What I can do is basically, at best, choose my current output as good as possible, given everything I've seen in the past, and produce that in the past, okay? And that's it. So just putting these two ideas in and taking a few derivatives gives you a way to find what this y vector is given x vector. And that is basically this dynamics here, okay? Which I will be interpreting as the activity of a neural network, and I'll basically describe it using this picture. So what's going to happen is you're going to have this vector come in, and you'll have the activity of this neural network. So it's going to be a recurrent one. There's going to be a feed-forward connectivity matrix, W, a lateral one, L. I put a minus sign because there's a minus sign over there. It's going to be not very important. The neurons are nonlinear. They have the so-called rectified linear nonlinearity. It's a very popular nonlinearity in machine learning. People have written many papers about why this is a good one. In my framework, it arises because of I'm doing a gradient descent, it's a projected gradient descent. I'm trying to project everything to non-negative orthant. That's why you get it. And that's it. Then this network basically recurrently converges to a fixed point. There's a Lyapunov function here if you're worried about it. And that's the output that you get from it. Excellent. So and notice that basically the rates and dynamics and nonlinearities all came from this similarity matching idea. And for the next time step, I have to update what these W and L matrices were. And I'm just writing those updates explicitly here. So Wij, which is the synaptic rate between jth input and ith output, is a function of itself, some learning rate, plus the activity of the jth input and activity of the ith output. It's totally local. It doesn't depend on anything else. This is a Hebbian update. And similarly, the lateral updates have exactly the same form. I'm calling them anti-Hebbian because of the minus sign over here. So let me just pause here for a second and tell you what I've achieved so far, right? So people have argued that local learning may not be optimal because it's uninformed. What I've shown you is that there's an optimization principle from the point of view of which local updates are actually the things that you want to do. They are basically gradient, descent, actually it's an ascent version here too, anyway, updates. That's excellent. Not just that, this Hebbian anti-Hebbian learning has a long history in the literature. It starts all the way from Foldiak in 1989. But up until now, it has been just postulated, like let's draw a circuit and put these rules in. This is the first time it has been related to a cost function, the power of which will be apparent in the next slides. And this is actually a good way of learning because of the following. Suppose you do not have these lateral slide connections. There was nothing of these L matrices. Everybody would be seeing the same thing and everybody doing the same update. So everybody would be learning the same thing, right? To make them learn different things and get a richer representation, you have to make them compete with each other in some way. And that's why that was a good and popular idea to introduce such lateral connections. Okay. And actually, it turns out, in this later paper, just came out, This can be related to a sort of a game played between some min-max optimization problem, it turns out, that's what's been solved here, between W and L synapses, and that has some input interpretation you can read over there. Okay, so that's good. So let me show you actually this thing in action. So what I'm going to put in is a bunch of natural scenes, meaning I'm going to take patches of natural scenes, make it into vectors, and feed it into this network, and make it learn something, and just repeat this for a long while. And then look at so-called receptive fields of these neurons. A receptive field, you can think of it as basically a feature that each of these neurons respond most to. So that's like a way to define them. Each of these little squares here correspond to one neuron's receptive field, and you find that they are responsive to oriented edges, much like the neurons in the primary visual cortex. And not just that, if you look at the histogram of activity, you'll find that activity is sparse, so that's a log-scale histogram, and this red arrow is the probability mass at zero, and you'll find that there's a big mass at zero and a heavy tail, which is sort of like the neurons in the primary visual cortex. So that's a good sanity check. Okay, so this is what I've shown until now. I've run through this program, but when I did this, I realized that there's more here. What I could do is, I could basically extend this framework, meaning I could come up with other tasks, okay, and basically find biologically plausible ways to solve them, okay, by adding more constraints and regularizers to my cost functions. So I'm basically building a library of things I can add to my cost functions from which I can derive biological networks. And that's how I came to this picture, right? So there's a bunch of things here. For each of them, I wrote down a cost function. From there, I did my tricks of taking derivatives and transformations and so on and so forth. And I ended up with neural networks of this sort. And like you might appreciate the features of these things, that they have things like interneurons and homeostatic plasticity and so on and so forth. And here's actually a table of optimization features. And so I showed you just the first two lines here, but there's a bunch here, some published, some not published, and the particular biological mechanism that might be implementing such features, things like interneurons and adaptive thresholds and, I don't know, inhibitor neurons all arise. And this is for the statisticians out there, and this got published in different places. But okay. So now I have built this catalog, I have access to it, what can I do with it? One thing you can do is start basically building, stacking them up, basically building more complicated circuits out of the catalog that you have to solve even harder tasks. So what I'm showing you is basically a stacked version of one circuit I've built, which solves a whitening task, it's a decorrelation task, which is important because this has been argued, for example, to be the function of your retina. Okay, coupled with the particular network I showed you. It turns out, and the proofs are in these papers, this particular version solves a latent variable extraction task, or a blind source separation task, or in other words for it is non-negative independent component analysis task, the details of which I'm not going to go into, but I'll just show an example of this network in action. Okay, so what's being solved is here's a following unsupervised learning problem. We have three sources, so these can be signals. I'm showing a visual version of this, but maybe many people speaking and you're hearing, you know, samples of mixed audio signals. What you observe is these mixtures. So this is what goes into your brain, these mixed signals. And what your task is from these mixed signals, without anyone telling you what the mixture sort of function is, to be able to recover what the sources were. Okay? This is called blind source separation in engineering. All right. Okay, so here's my network in action. So this is what the network sees. This is what it recovers. It's operating online. So if you actually look at it carefully, it repeats every now and then. Its performance is getting better and better over time. And I want to point to one thing. So the network that solves this behind the scenes have only 9 units in them. So just 9. So 2-layer network, 6 in the first layer, 3 in the second layer. There is no like 100 layers of deep learning or backpropagation, anything of this sort. All simple Hebbian updates, simple nonlinearities, 9 units. And the reason it does it this well is because I designed it to solve this task this way, okay? Because I put all my cost functions and carefully thought about how this should be working. But the point I want to make with this is basically the power of this approach, right? This approach gives me efficient ways of solving problems. Therefore, the brain might have solved these efficient ways rather than taking a deep network and fine-tuning it until you get the exact input-output function you want. And that's exactly the thing I want to do with this framework, right? Basically, look for real circuits in the brain and with the circuits I built and compare them and make predictions about them and build an understanding about them. So a lot of connectome data sets are going to come out soon. So there will be, I think, a lot of room for such kind of theory to be built. But I want to give you a particular ongoing work about a particular circuit that I'm doing this with. And it's a circuit from insect olfaction. And I'm going to relate it to soft clustering. So this is the circuit. So this is an olfactory circuit in locust. Odor molecules come, they map to olfactory receptor neurons. The first layer of processing is called, it happens in a place called antennal lobe. There's a bunch of neurons here called projection neurons. The representation here is dense, meaning to each odorant, almost everybody fires. Okay? And from there, there's a second layer of processing. That's the initial stage of the entrance stage of the mushroom body. And that's the particular circuit I'm going to be comparing to. So the circuit looks peculiar. So you have 50,000 of cells, which are called canyon cells. They are all sitting there, okay? They don't talk to each other directly, but they talk to each other through one inhibitory neuron, which is called the giant, interneuron. So all 50,000 guys connect to one guy, and it feeds back lateral inhibition to everybody else. And the activity here is extremely sparse. So basically, a few canyon cells would light up to a particular order. So you go from a dense representation to a sparse representation, and you go to this peculiar connectivity. The question is, what is the computational purpose of this representation building, and why is it wired this way? Okay? And having gained experience of playing games with these cost functions, I realized that basically I can get such a circuit from clustering. The clustering is the following idea, right? Someone gives you a bunch of points, you're supposed to divide them up into groups. Soft clustering is the following idea. You might have some point which you're not sure exactly what cluster it belongs to, so you might assign it to multiple clusters. So I started with a soft k-means clustering. K-means are a very standard clustering algorithm, a soft version of it. Basically turned it into a similarity matching or alignment problem and ran this program and came up with a circuit that looks like this, which has exactly the same architecture. Just to make sure you're on the same page, here a neuron lights up. That means I believe that the input belongs to the cluster I represent. So they are signaling cluster attribution indices. Okay? Okay, but once I have access to a circuit and a cost function, that allows me to do two things, and that's why I'm actually doing all this program. The first thing I told you, right? So it gives me computational interpretations of the features of this circuit. For example, right? These canyon cells are rectifying, meaning they're not sitting on a firing base firing rate and going up and down, but they're mostly silent and they just only fire every now and then. Is because they are signaling cluster attribution indices, which are zeros or ones. You know, they're not like that's what it is. There's one neuron in this interneuron in circuitry because there is one optimization constraint that relates to k-means clustering. Basically, the activities of these cases should sum to some number, and that's what it's implementing. Few canyon cells are active at some time because this is a soft clustering problem, so assigning things to a few clusters. And Hebbian learning and has to do with similarity alignment. So that gives you a way to interpret, you know, basically the biology from a computational point of view. And not just that, allows you to make predictions, right? Because you're thinking now the circuit is doing clustering, here's a prediction. So it's known that canyon cells here are responsive to odorants, which are made of single molecules. People have recorded a lot of these things. But if the circuit is clustering, then you can have a situation where you're presented with an odor mixture, so not just a single odorant molecule, but a mixture of them. And you might be assigning these mixtures to a different cluster than the molecules themselves, which predicts that there should be a canyon cell, for example, which would respond to mixtures, but not the constituents themselves. And so, and if you look at the literature, you'll find that, you know, there have been neurons recorded this way. And that's a clear prediction of this theory. And of course, I want to be able to make more predictions of this sort. And to be able to do that, I have to come up with sort of more and more biologically plausible circuits. And for that, I have to extend my catalog. And that's another future direction, basically extend this catalog. Which means also one way I am doing this, and this is going to be presented at COSINE in 2 weeks. COSINE is a computational and system theory science conference. Is basically all the neurons that I've been talking to you about today are so-called point neurons. They see and weigh each neuron in a sort of equal footing, but real neurons have spatial features, you know, dendrites, and especially basal and apical dendrites, so on and so forth. And so what I'm trying to do is basically starting from the so-called canonical correlation analyses to come up with algorithms that could be implemented by neurons that have special extensions. Canonical correlation analysis is the following idea. You have two different data sets, okay, and you're trying to find directions in those two data sets such that they're correlated across, most correlated across. So you can think of this as basically one data set being most predictive of the second data set. That's the idea. And here, one set of inputs, for example, might be coming from feed-forward inputs, and the other data set might be coming from feedback, and you want to correlate. Okay. And the other way I want to use this kind of catalog is basically look for hard problems that the brain solves, and using my cost functions, come up with ways that the brain could be solving them, therefore generating hypotheses from which, you know, you can come up with experimental predictions. So the particular problem I'm going to describe today is basically learning representations for object recognition. It's going to relate to the first two slides that I've shown you. And object recognition can be described in many different sensory modalities. The main problem here is variability in viewpoint, and that's shown in this picture. You know, you can take a look at a chair from all these different variations, yet your brain is able to still recognize invariant of the viewpoint, or also occlusions, scales, all sorts of variations. So how does the brain solve it? There are studies, computational studies, which show that if you take this variability in viewpoint away, the problem becomes easily solvable. Okay? So the way I want to approach this problem is basically thinking about similarity transformations that might be applicable to this problem, formulate them in terms of cost functions, and build cascades of neurons that solve this problem. To be more concrete, there is actually a particular proposal in neuroscience literature, which has been described in words but never put into equations, that how such a thing can be working. So that's called the manifold untangling view. And that works as follows. Think of the image of an object that falls onto your retina. Okay, so in the pixel space, so however many pixels you have, that's a point. Okay, all natural variations of this object, basically rotation, scale, so on and so forth, trace a smooth surface on that space, but it's a manifold. So you can think of different objects as different manifolds in this high-dimensional space. Excellent. Okay, what a neuron can do is basically, in terms of recognition, add stuff linearly, weigh them, and then threshold them. That's basically putting a hyperplane in the space and telling if a point is on one side of this hyperplane or another side of this hyperplane. It turns out, and these object manifolds are extremely tangled, meaning you cannot put hyperplanes, linearly separating hyperplanes, in the pixel space. That's what this picture is showing. So therefore, people hypothesize that the role of processing in the brain is to come up with representations in which these manifolds become untangled, by which I mean you can start putting these hyperplanes in between them. Therefore, a neuron that's looking into this particular representation, and here the axis will be firing rates of neurons, can be able to not just discriminate these objects, but also do it in an invariant manner because, you know, all the variations are still falling in one side of the plane. That's it. So the hypothesis is basically that's what cascades of processing in the brain looks like. There's all these local untanglers that are looking at the images and their representations, and basically low coding this untangling operation after which you come to this particular representation. So here is a very preliminary simulation of me doing this. What I did here is actually I wrote down a cost function of untangling, Okay, I'm not going to show it. I'm not showing it, but if you ask me later, I can show you the cost function. Okay, and I got networks from it, and I built a cascade of 5 layers of processing. Okay, so what's being shown here is the following. Here you're looking at a data set. So think of each of these arms of a spiral as a different object. All right, so object and its variations, for example. So the network sees a vector in this two-dimensional space, does its dynamics, update, and another vector, so on and so forth. So it goes over the status at many, many times. So below, what I'm showing you here are receptive fields of these neurons, by which I mean the following. Each square here corresponds to a neuron, and blue means that neuron is not responding to that point, and yellow means the neuron is responding to that point. For example, this neuron here responds only to those points in that spiral. That's what it learns over multiple layers of, multiple steps of learning. Across multiple layers of processing, you'll start finding neurons, okay, that are responding to larger portions of this spiral. And by the time you end up at layer 5, there's a neuron that responds to all points in this particular arm of the spiral, and there's another neuron that responds to all points on that particular arm of the other spiral. And why is this a good thing? And let's go back to the first slide I told you. Suppose now this spiral was coming from an object A and that was coming from an object B, right? Someone told me that, gave me a label, supervision, told me that this point, a point here, is object A. This neuron lights up, and some other person told me that any point here or one point here is object B, and that other neuron lights up. So just from these two examples, now I can learn to solve this classification problem. Right? I can assign this neuron to object A and that neuron to object B, and done. And all its natural variations are all already solved because, you know, any other point lights up the same neuron. Okay. Yes.
So what exactly was the learning dynamics here? Okay. So you were still optimizing your similarity measure?
I'll show you to it when I finish it. So it is a similarity-based cost function. I'll show it to you after I finish. I wrote a different cost function to solve this problem. Okay. So, yeah, so what I plan to do, and it's a very preliminary simulation here, is basically using these ideas to build theories of neural representations that can be learned from object manifolds, being accessed to object manifolds. Okay, so to summarize, I've shown you what I called the similarity matching theory, although similarity matching only relates to some part of it, it's much more than that. Okay, it's a powerful normative theory of biological and artificial, I didn't show you, unsupervised learning that operates at multiple levels. It uses similarity transformations as its building blocks. And here are its achievements. I've given new optimization formulations of common unsupervised learning tasks, so achievements at that level. The algorithms I get from it turn out to be competitive in machine learning tasks. I've shown it, other people have shown it too. I didn't show it to you today, but I published it. It turns out these are advantageous for hardware applications. Some people are trying to build hardware because these are operating distributed settings that might be useful. It answers how efficient self-organization for learning happens with local plasticity. I've built new circuit motifs and mechanisms that could be used in the brain, and also I've shown you that this theory can be used to come up with experimental predictions about specific circuits, and there come up with computational interpretations. Okay, so I just showed you my last few years of work on unsupervised learning. Just in the remaining 2 minutes or so, I don't know if I have the remaining 2 minutes, but I'll take 2 more minutes. I just want to say a few more words. My interest in learning is not just about unsupervised learning. For a while, I've been collaborating with experimentalists at Harvard about reinforcement learning, and these are experiments done on songbirds, and I've been helping them with the data analysis and also building models of explaining their findings. In particular, in a recently accepted paper and also a previous paper, we showed basically that the bird can actually process multiple rewards in parallel in a single trial of a song production, and I've come up with models of how you would implement this in neural circuits, and that has implications for larger contexts of motor skill learning, and if you ask me, I'll tell you about that. And beyond learning too, if you look at my past work, I've worked on things like other stuff than learning, for example, how the brain might be recovering from lesions in songbirds. This might be of interest to people in the audience. I built neuromechanical, which means biomechanics coupled to neural controllers of models of Drosophila larvae, how they call, explaining their phenomenology, making predictions about what happens if you put in a slippery surface, for example, and other learning-related problems, and then perhaps over like more data analysis problems about analyzing data that comes from a retina, and discover a wide range of mathematical techniques from machine learning, physics, optimization theory, and so on and so forth. And these are my collaborators and funding since I've left Brown and being a computational neuroscientist. Thank you.
So if you go back to this manifold unfolding, unfolding
yes.
issue, you're looking at basically how deeper and deeper layers generalize better, right? So that those neurons respond to much larger.
Yes.
Part of the manifold. However, if you compare these layers in a continuous fashion, you see that this increase in coverage, in response, is related to how close you are on the manifold, or does it just, you know, connect them?
Yeah, I think to answer that, let me just explicitly show you the cost function for these, and it will be clear. Okay. So it's what it is. It's very similar to what I showed before. So it has, again, these outputs. Think of this S as a similarity function. It takes, it can be a dot product. I can also do negative Euclidean distances in a biological plausible way. And what it does is the following. It says, I have a constraint here too. Okay. Suppose, so alpha is a parameter, and that's going to be the answer to your question. Suppose two points had similarity more than alpha, more similar than alpha. So this is a negative number. I'm trying to minimize this, so I want to make this guy as large as possible with that constraint, which means that I'm going to try to represent those points by unit vectors, just with unit overlap. So I'll try to make them represent them as the same guy, same vector. Okay. And if this is, I'll come to this, less than alpha, that's a positive number, minimize this with the non-negative numbers, I'm going to try to represent them with vectors that do not overlap. So if similar, try to represent them the same thing. If dissimilar, try to represent them with of non-overlapping neurons. And this alpha is the parameter that sets the scale of local similarity. So in that simulation, that alpha was changing across multiple layers. And how you should learn this alpha is a different problem. So I did not address this. Yes?
Sorry, so what is X?
Okay, so X in the first layer refers to the stimuli. And for later layers, it refers to the input to that layer. So it will be X of one layer is going to be the Y of the previous layer.
And the stimulus, so literally is around 56 squared, the ones and zeros.
It has some graded numbers in between them, yes.
So that's sort of the whole image.
That's whole image. I'd make it into an X vector. And that's sort of response to what you're
looking for. Is happening just on that single input.
Yes.
So they're not shown to multiple spirals or anything like that.
No, it's just one. It's just one spiral. Yeah. So for this particular example, the inputs are two-dimensional vectors coming from this data set. This is the whole data set. Right? So there's just two numbers that go. That red point is a point that goes here, basically. Is that okay? Or
Still not entirely sure. So, wait, so this was X sub R, right?
Yes. So X sub R.
What? So X is this
the R would be R would be all these data points. So suppose this is one.
So X refers to just a single pixel in that image, not the whole image.
No. X points to an image, but what I'm showing you here is not the image. I'm showing you, so each point here is an image, if you will.
Okay.
Okay.
And then similarity is, so I'm just trying to understand
That's important.
As a machine here, as a learning machine, what exactly we're disentangling there. So similarity is continuity of these
exactly.
Objects. So for example, if I break one of the spirals, into two halves, will the algorithm discover three?
Yes. So I'll tell you. So the disentangling is happening because of this cost function, which I tried to argue that sets a local scale of similarity alpha. If two objects are more similar than alpha, try to represent them as the same thing or put them as, think of them as the same object. Greater than alpha, think of them as distinct objects. You can prove, I'm not going to show it, but in the limit that you have many, many output neurons, the optimal solution to this cost function is going to be the following. If within a manifold, all nearest neighbor distances are, or similarities are greater than alpha, and across manifold similarities are always less than alpha, this is going to learn a representation where different manifolds are mapped to distinct neural populations. So that can be proved. Yeah. And that's how I set it up. Yes.
So it seems like both of the computational vision tasks you kind of brought up, so both the invariance representation and the source separation, there would be a lot of benefit from extracting temporal information. So
beautiful question, yes.
Yeah.
And let me speak to that, certainly.
If I understand correctly, the model, you're kind of updating with the Hebbian, anti-Hebbian kind of in single snapshots. Like, is there any way to, and I might have missed something, but is there any way to kind of be able to take advantage more of that temporal information using the real point time?
Beautiful. Certainly. Direction of mind to address these questions. As of now, I'm not making use of them. So let me tell you why this picture fails, and that's because of the question that you asked. So the particular cost function I wrote assumes that I've seen the whole manifold. I have samples from the whole manifold. And in terms of real life, what that means is I have seen an object in all sorts of variations and poses and so on and so forth, which is not true, right? So all what you have access to is only sort of maybe through tracing an object move along your visual field. So that's a little bit of a trajectory here, and another object moving along there, that's a little bit of a trajectory here. So it's crucial for someone to make use of temporal information from which to be able to extract what these local sort of dimensions or of these manifolds look like. And certainly, and like there's a lot of work in machine learning in that, and I have some ideas of how to implement that, but that's where this model fails, and that's where I think the key question is, and that's what I intend to do. I'll tell you more about it later, but yeah, sure.
First of all, let me say that I feel that I'm old enough to ask a meta question rather than how you talk, rather than a specific question.
And that's, yeah.
So, you know, when I, over the last 30 years, I've heard a lot of talks about these models of the brain and so on and so forth. And they all sound similar. Layers of neurons and similarity matrices, input functions, updating, changing the synapse.
I would say, okay.
So, as a physicist, when I go to a physics talk, I of course know how to tell the high quality talks from the low quality talks. Go to a talk and I say, oh, this talk is much better than anything I've heard in the last few years, because it takes us closer to understanding black hole, the brain, or whatever, right? And the other criterion is that I hear some shockingly new ideas, some big surprises that nobody had heard of. There's some new concept and so on. So for all I know, your talk is much better than any of the other
talk
I've heard. I've heard a whole bunch around the world and in the US. So could you teach me what is the criterion for judging talks?
Judging talks.
What is the big event? What is the surprise? Maybe I'm old enough to ask this
So to my contribution, I can say that my particular contribution was building cost functions out of similarity matrices and show that how that naturally gets implemented by Hebbian learning, which is a key concept in neuroscience, and therefore basically opening the way to cost functions for biologically plausible learning. So that's my contribution.
So this is something that nobody else had 20 years ago?
No. Judging talks, yeah, I'll probably talk about it in private, not here.
So, despite my age, can I ask a more technical question?
Please go ahead, yeah.
So, So early on, you said so you tested the algorithm on some clustering and maybe the noise.
Yes. Yes.
And so speaking of quality control, so you haven't actually told us in some quantitative way how well this algorithm behaves, presumably compared to others. But my technical question is, right, so you have these X's and Y's, and they have different dimensions, and presumably to do some of this entangling, I have to embed in perhaps the higher dimension. So how does the performance depend, for example, on embedded dimensions?
Okay, those are multiple questions here. First, comparison to other algorithms. Let's see what I have here. So it turns out, I'll say it in words, and I'll also mention one simulation. A lot of the algorithms I built are competitive, so the way I would quantify it is basically make like some plots like this, come up with data sets, and compare different algorithms on the same task. And here's, for example, algorithms competitive. It's basically on this source separation task, I'm comparing to a very popular algorithm, FastICA. If it falls down, it means more better recovery. For example, the PCA algorithm I built is very good. It loses to one out of a lot of things I checked. Other people also, some computer scientists, have actually taken these algorithms and compared it to some algorithms from machine learning as feature extractors, by which I mean you come up with Y's, and on Y's you train classifiers to recognize objects. And you know, if it's not the best, it's the second or something. So there's a lot of ways this has been quantified to be useful. But I must say to that question the following. Right? So my job here was never, I'm going to come up with the algorithm that beats everyone else. Right? I'm coming, trying to do something else here. But it turns out these algorithms are competitive, so which is good. You had a second question, which was about...
Well, how performance depends on embedding.
Okay, embedding dimensions. Embedding dimensions become important. It's a parameter, and I don't... So what happens is... it certainly changes the performance. For example, in this particular task of, so I have to talk task by task, of recovering sources, well, maybe for the other one, this is okay. It can get worse or it can get better depending on what the task is. So you have to find an optimal way of setting what those dimensions are. Okay, and so it's a parameter, you have to search for an optimal way. So one way I address this problem is doing this setting dimensions in an online manner. So the biological implementation of this is not clear, and I'm talking of things like neurogenesis here. The idea would be start running your simulation. At each point, basically compare your overall performance of matching similarity, and if it's bad, add another guy, neuron to it, another guy to it, and basically try to come up with an online, on-the-fly way of coming up with a number of neurons that solve the task in a reasonable way. But yeah, so I don't have a formula, but I have some heuristics to address this problem.
So it appears your similarity measure is based entirely on the physical properties of objects, but one could argue that evolution has built multiple similarity measures in different species, or different context, and so on and so forth. So some objects that are very similar will be perceived very differently in different contexts, and my similarity measure may be very different from that of the bat.
True.
Or some other species. Could you give a comment on this?
I mean, that is very true. I mean, certainly with bats and us, we're presumably working different tasks, and these could be different. That's why I'm trying to look at up. I mean, but this whole picture also shows that, you know, across species there might be some commonalities too. So I think the answer is, you know, think about the species, think about the problems it solves, and try to come up with a clever guess to what exactly task it's solving, and try to form it problems this way.
Except that this one is a little stretched. It's only the visual sensory input. Now, if you had all the inputs coming in at the same time, sensory, olfactory,
yeah, certainly,
all of it, they might actually be represented.
Well, it's true. That is true. I agree. Yeah. But I'm starting with a simplified hypothesis here. That's what I'm doing. But I must say, for example, I showed you this fly example where I thought the task was clustering, which would have given a different sort of a similarity. Yeah, so that goes into my work too. I mean, all of these other algorithms I showed postulate that the output similarity matrix looks different, right? So it's not just...
So your measure, just last question, your measure does not depend on the level of abstraction. It just depends on the actual physical measurable properties. It doesn't depend on how actually it's embedded in my abstract space.
By abstract space, you mean probably a... I mean, I have to make a statement about how to represent a stimulus. For example, here, for visual stimuli, I think of it as a vector and pixel space. For olfaction, I think of it as basically, I'm vector, elements of which are concentrations of molecules, and there's these kinds of things that needs to be built into these theories. I have another question. Okay.
Can I ask another question?
Go ahead, please, yes. Your job is to ask, my job is to answer.
So you're talking about the entangling and symmetry manifold, and of course that's what convolutional neural networks all claim to accomplish, and the convolutional structure was introduced to represent whatever dilation, rotation.
These
deformation manifolds. So. What is the statement? Can I conclude that this convolutional property emerges from the similarity optimization?
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at for this particular. First of all, convolution only solves translational invariance and other things. And this is exactly solving that problem. Right? So there's a symmetry along this. Symmetry in the sense that all points here should be represented by the same thing. So I'm changing my object along this manifold, but the neuron's output doesn't change. So that's a symmetry. Yeah.
I really thought that orientation of areas would be solved by CNNs.
So orientation invariance is the following. So the convolution operation gets you translation, but what's the convolution kernel? If the convolution kernel is oriented edges, right? So then that solves it. So you might have oriented edges here and here and here and here. Right, so if you have a convolution plus max pooling, I guess you know this in terminology. That's all. It's a combination of what the convolution operation plus what the convolution kernel is. Am I clear? Am I not clear?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Okay. Yes, certainly.
Okay. So if there are no more questions, let's
start with the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you.